Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Today in Richmond, Virginia, the former capital of the Confederacy, there is one less controversial statue standing. Protesters late last night toppled the statue of Confederate President Jefferson Davis on Monument Avenue. And this comes after Virginia Governor Ralph Northam said the state would remove another nearby statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee as soon as possible. What's going on in Richmond is just one example of how the debate over Confederate statues has reignited as people throughout the country re-examine racial inequality. And now we're going to take a deeper look at the significance of the violence we've witnessed at some of these ongoing protests. At the onset of the unrest, when people started burning cars and destroying property, some argued that the nonviolent protest movement of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. should be the model for today's activists. But our next guest says violence has long been a part of bringing about racial justice. Kelly Carter Jackson is a professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College and author of the new book, Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionists and the Politics of Violence. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with this argument we hear being made sometimes that Martin Luther King Jr. preached nonviolence. So perhaps there is no place for violence in today's fight for justice. What do you say to that?
Oh, man, I push back on that pretty hard. I think that the entire civil rights movement was a movement, an organized movement in response to violence. That the entire movement was about violence and how people should respond to it. And when I talk about violence, I talk about the murder of Emmett Till. I talk about the murder of four little girls in a church, or the assassination of Medgar Evers, of Malcolm X, or Martin Luther King Jr. himself. This movement was rife with violence. And I think that deserves a thorough examination. And I think it's that something that needs to be discussed when we talk about the civil rights movement. I think we've been too comfortable about looking back at this past with sort of rose-colored glasses about how people responded to their oppression.
You say that violence goes all the way back in the founding of the United States. And the death of Crispus Attucks, the first person, a black man killed at the Boston Massacre. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. So I live in the Boston area. And if you do, you know that K through 12 students are all introduced to Crispus Attucks. I would say across the nation, when we are discussing the American Revolution, one of the first names we learn is that of Crispus Attucks, because he is believed to be the first casualty of the American Revolution. And so we talk about him as a patriot, but what we don't really discuss is the fuller story of that moment, that Crispus Attucks was, throwing rocks. Some people say snowballs, some people say pieces of wood. But nevertheless, an altercation ensued. And when British soldiers fired and killed Crispus Attucks and several others, these British soldiers were brought to trial. And our former president, John Adams, defended them. And the way he did that was by essentially pulling the race card, by saying, look at Crispus Attucks, this black man, this mulatto, this tall, terrifying man. Of course, the British soldiers would be in fear for their lives. And when I started reading the court documents, I was like, oh, my gosh, this language is so similar to the language that we use today when we talk about cops who were in fear for their lives, or why someone may have taken this violent response. And so I realized that this, what we're looking at, is actually not new at all. It's actually quite old.
Early abolitionists espoused the idea of moral suasion, that being the idea that you could just talk slave owners into freeing their slaves by convincing them it was wrong. I mean, how did that go?
Not so well. You know, I think that if we think about it in the moment, you know, in the 1830s, they're experiencing the Second Great Awakening. So it's this religious revival going all across the country where people believe that, you know, Christ is going to return, that he's going to come back, and that he better not come back and find you a slaveholder, right? That slavery is a sin. It is something that we should repent of. It is a moral crime. And so abolitionists thought that they could really use moral suasion to persuade slaveholders into freeing their slaves. What they didn't realize, or maybe what they didn't appreciate, was the economic stronghold that the institution of slavery had on this country, and that it was going to be nearly impossible to convince anyone to forfeit their economic well-being, let alone their power and political power at that.
I want to ask you about something else. Most of these protests have been peaceful, but there have been violent incidents, including rioting and looting. Is there any way to see looting as beneficial to the overall cause of social justice? Or should we purely be looking at this as an opportunism?
Oh, you know, it's complicated. That's the short answer. I say yes and no, in the sense that I think that we have looked at looters and we have looked at overturned cars or destroyed businesses, and we have put too much attention on them by putting the destruction of property on par with the destruction of Black people, with the death of George Floyd. I don't think that's right at all. I don't think you should ever compare people and property. That's exactly what happened in slavery. On the other hand, I do think that if we're not careful and if we don't listen to the fact that people are angry and that people are enraged, and if we don't respond to the violence that we're seeing, not necessarily with law and order and tanks and guns, but if we don't respond with real systemic change, then we are doomed to repeat this cycle over and over again. You know, a lot of people have been using the MLK quote, which is, a riot is the language of the unheard. And I think that if we're not careful in this moment to really listen and to really learn about these grievances and why people are so upset, we will find ourselves here again in another 5 or 10 years.
We've been hearing from allies who have been speaking very directly about the need for change and acknowledging systemic racism. You've talked quite a bit about the importance of knowing your history, and specifically Black history. Do you also see this a moment in time where we may be rethinking the way we educate our young people about the origins of this country and systemic racism?
Absolutely. You know, I really hope that we are moving into a moment where African American history is not treated as an elective, but a requirement. I think it should be something that everyone knows and learns and understands. I think that in addition to learning, we have a lot of unlearning to do. We have been given really problematic versions of history and really problematic versions of other ethnic groups. And that we have to work through to really unlearn. You know, a perfect example, I think, is I'm conflicted by this because my son's school is trying to talk about these issues, and he's 6. And, you know, they were trying to give him a storybook. And in the storybook, it was about how this girl who was brown was being discriminated against, and no one would play with her because she was brown. And the moral of the story was, skin color doesn't matter, and that she should be played with. But I realized that in telling that story, we also sort of subconsciously reinforce these ideas of difference, so that children who may have been unaware of the politics of skin color are now aware that this is a problem, right? And so, you know, children were presented with the narrative of, here's a little white girl and she's been tormented for her white skin and her blonde hair. That was not the story. It was, the story is, here's a Black girl where her skin color is the problem. That's the, you know, the overall message, or I would say the subconscious message that children will internalize, even when you tell them that this is wrong. The understanding is, or the starting point is, people believe this is right.
Do you see this moment as different?
I do see this moment as different. I mean, I live in the town of Wellesley, which is very white and affluent, and I have seen more Black Lives Matter signs than Black people. And, you know, I do think that there is a different feel or texture about this current protest movement, who you see protesting, how you see them protesting, and the quick response to making reform has been sort of mind-blowing. But I think the real change will happen in, you know, what do police departments look like going forward? If we're just talking about police reform and police brutality, will these four officers involved in Minneapolis, will they be held accountable? Will they get probation? Will they get a prison sentence? Will it be 2 years? Will it be 20 years? You know, how these officers are held accountable, I think will say a lot. But also being able to create real structural, systemic, lasting, sustaining change is what's going to take this beyond the protest and into a better future if we're willing to do the work.
Professor Kelly Carter Jackson is the author of Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionists and the Politics of Violence. Professor Carter Jackson, thank you so much.
Thank you.